dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, one of the favorite sources for our program's assessment of the state of the free world is, of course, the inimitable Diana West, a syndicated columnist for many years. These days, she blogs at dianawest.net. She is the author of three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread. We're graced by her just about every week, for which we are eternally grateful. And Diana, this is no exception. Thank you for joining us. Good to have you back.
Oh, wonderful to be with you, Frank.
Well, Diana, one of the things that is a telltale in the state of this war for the free world is what has been happening in the United Kingdom to what I guess one might call a dissident in the old days, someone who is standing up for freedom in the face of increasingly tyrannical behavior on the part of his government. In this case, I'm talking about Tommy Robinson. Tell me what's the story with Tommy, sort of if you give a little bit of background for those who haven't been following his case, but the latest turn of events.
Yes, well, the story of Tommy Robinson is one of these epic events that come to pass occasionally in history. I mean, he is a historic figure, a virtuosic political genius in some ways, somebody who connects with people with tremendous charm and verve and naturalness. He's not someone, a product of any university. He comes from the mean streets. He's a bloke. He's a normal man who saw what was happening to Britain over these past years and tried to create public democratic opposition to the imposition of Sharia norms, Sharia compliance in the British legal system, in the just overwhelming effects of mass migration from largely Islamic countries that have changed literally the face of England. And by design, as we found in a recent biography of Tony Blair, this mass migration into England was something that the educated British elites sought as a means to, yes, change England, the population, forever to make it, quote, multicultural. Well, it has effectively made it, quote, Islamic, quote, communist, quote, everything that does require a tyrannical state to control the people, to control people like Tommy Robinson, who are trying to say no and change destiny through political democratic means. So this is Tommy Robinson, who's, because of his connection with people, his popularity with normal people, and the way he gives people a voice and encourages them, he became literally the enemy of this tyrannical British state, which has imprisoned him. It's a long saga, the saga of Tommy Robinson. Most recently, he has literally been sent to jail on trumped-up charges. He's been sent to maximum security Belmarsh, which is known as a jihadi training ground because so many of the inmates are jihadis in training. It is perhaps a death sentence given the animosity that the Muslim population has for Tommy's efforts to prevent England from becoming Muslim. It is a very dangerous place for him. He's been in before, he's been beaten up before, he's been all the rest of it. This is a terrible moment for him, and he has literally made an appeal for asylum to President Trump directly in interviews, most recently on InfoWars with Alex Jones, because of this dire condition. The case was an abomination. There were not even sentencing guidelines. There were not even sentencing guidelines for this literally trumped up charge of effectively doing journalism. He was doing a live broadcast into his phone on public property during a sentencing period of a literally a Muslim rape gang, and he was sent to jail for contempt of court, even though it's a legalistic rigmarole, but he was in violation, they say, of bans on public discussion of this ongoing court case. However, there was no, he had tried to inquire about the rules. There were various blocks on him getting information, et cetera. It was a ridiculous kind of contempt of court charge that no one has ever gone to prison for. So this is what we're seeing, is the state just punishing him, stopping him, trying to chill others who may follow in his footsteps. And it's an absolute shame on Britain. It's an abomination on human rights. You can hardly think of words that are more dire to describe what Britain is like if they put someone like him in prison for doing what he did, whereas this nation that used to be a shining light in terms of speech and rights and democracy is absolutely turned on its head in its predicament of trying to control people who are at each other's throats, given this terrible situation that they have created.
Yeah. So putting it slightly differently, Diana West, what we're watching is Her Majesty's government effectively engaging in the most rank acts of submission to the Sharia supremacists. And in the course of it, they are imprisoning and putting in mortal peril an individual who has simply pointed out that's what's going on. And you mentioned the trial, for heaven's sakes, that he was trying to report about. This is a trial involving the so-called grooming gangs in Britain that have been doing unbelievably horrific things to thousands and thousands and thousands of British girls and women. And the fact that the government has been complicit in covering up some of this behavior and thereby enabling it is simply staggering. It makes all the more outrageous what they've done to this individual, calling them out on it. Diana, let me just quickly switch to somebody else in the United Kingdom who has also spent his life challenging totalitarianism and the, you know, oppressiveness that emanates from it. Vladimir Bukovsky, his book Judgment in Moscow has finally been released. We don't have time to even begin to do justice to it, but just a quick appreciation of the importance of this work at this particular moment in time.
Yes, well, the book is a massively important, massively important to our understanding of what has happened to us. And it does apply directly to what has happened in Britain, to what has happened here, in terms of the corruption, the collusion, the submission, if you will, to tyranny, and the failure to reckon with it, to expose those who have so engaged in these tyrannical exploits of once proud and striving and growing democracies. So, you know, in terms of trying to do justice to it, no, we can't in a sentence or two, but the importance of Judgment in Moscow cannot be overestimated. It's a difficult work, but it is a great service to us and a great light to us if we take its lessons and learning to heart.
Diana West, thank you for your time today. We'll talk with you again next week, Diana. God bless you.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Dr. Harold Rode, one of the country's leading experts on several of the places in the Middle East of great interest to us, most especially at the moment, the country of Iran. He formerly served as a senior advisor in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as both a desk officer, as they call them, for Turkey for a time, and also as just one of the duty experts on Iran over many years. He worked with the illustrious Andrew Marshall in the Office of Net Assessment for many years. And I'm very pleased to say, since he left government service, he has continued rendering public service, notably as a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute. And in his writings, including several for the Center for Security Policy Press, one of my personal favorites is Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Harold Rode, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Nice to be here, Frank. Nice to hear your voice.
Harold, Iran is very much in the news at the moment, of course. It is gaining headlines and considerable attention because increasingly it is taking steps that are very provocative. It is blowing up vessels. It is seizing vessels. It is shooting down drones. Its proxies, at least, are engaged in physical attacks on the ground against American targets. You have expressed some concern, which I must say I very much share, about the lack of a response to date to most, if not all, of those actions by Iran. Walk us through, from your deep knowledge of the psychology of mullahs in Iran and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, how are they perceiving the restraint that President Trump has exercised to date, as more or less have others in the West?
Well, there's a bottom line here. The people running that country, Iran, right now, believe that if they provoke a conflagration with the outside world, with their enemies, that their messiah figure called the Mahdi will reappear and save them. Therefore, the doctrine we used to call under the Soviets, the mutual assured destruction, MAD, doesn't apply here. A conflict is an incentive. And that's, to me, the bottom line, what they're trying to do here. They're trying to provoke us. Now, there's another aspect which is extremely important here, and that is all throughout the Middle East, and specifically with Iran, if someone attacks you and you do nothing, you are showing weakness. That's how they perceive it. And that means that gives them an added incentive to push even further, to hit even further. Now, we may feel very happy with ourselves that we're expressing restraint. In no way am I arguing for a ground attack here. We don't need to use ground forces. I'm not a military man, but I have had enough discussions with naval people and with Air Force people to know that we can easily take care of this problem and stop it should we want to. And I would just hope, or we can use this, something I know nothing about is cyber. We can do all sorts of things to shut them down, to stop them. Now, if we don't do it from their perspective, we are showing weakness and they will hurt us more. So restraint beyond the point, and I don't know what that point is, seems to me to be counterproductive. It sounds in an odd way, the way in the 1930s, what happened with Hitler. Hitler went into the Saarland and we did nothing. That was an area which, according to the Versailles Treaty, was neutral. They weren't allowed to, it wasn't allowed to be armed. And since we, meaning the Western world, did nothing, Hitler was emboldened. That's the way the Iranians are feeling right now, emboldened.
Mm-hmm. That's the really worrying thing, is that you'll, especially if they are bent on precipitating a violent conflict, that there's no downside from their point of view to continuing to be provocative and to ratchet things up. So, Harold, you're counseling basically strong retaliatory action, but not necessarily of the physical variety, certainly not the ground kind, but even perhaps involving conventional naval and air forces. There has to be a cost, but not one that gives them their way in terms of, a cataclysm. Have I got that right?
Yes, a cataclysm. I don't think that, from our point of view, I don't think that is necessary. I think that, in fact, I know that the Iranian people in general are watching us like hawks. In the last few weeks, we have seen more and more instances of women out in the streets without hijabs, that is complete covering, which is totally against their rules, the Islamic Republic rules. They're watching, and if we are going to weaken their the government that rules them, then they are emboldened. That is the real thing that we could use, that the Iranian people so desperately want. They want to be freed from this this tyranny that rules them. Our job is not to do it for them, but our job is to worry, in this case, about ourselves. If they are going to attack us, we must respond. Hmm.
And it seems to me what you're saying is there that we want to respond in a way that emboldens, in the best sense of the word, the Iranian people to feel we're on their side. Yes. We may even provide some kinds of material support to them, but it's their fight. We're just not, as was true under Obama, on the side of the mullahs. Which brings me to this point that the president has made reference now on several occasions to his desire to negotiate some sort of new deal to replace the one with the mullahs that Obama and company signed, their nuclear weapons program. And Harold wrote, he also indicated that his policy was not regime change. How is that being perceived both by, you know, the Ayatollahs as well as the people of Iran?
Well, let's start with one word, confusion. On one hand, he has a much stronger policy. He is squeezing the regime through the sanctions. The great thing I think he could do is stop there, I think, 7 waivers of sanctions that they could be stopped. That's take away the waivers. That's number one. When it comes to negotiations in the Middle East, and specifically in this case, Iran, you only negotiate after you win. Now, how is it possible to negotiate after you win? It's when you show the other side that there's no way out. Then you dictate the terms under which they live. And they do things. The negotiations means the winner dictates the terms. Negotiations beforehand exactly. Negotiations before victory is a sign of weakness, that you either don't have the will or the ability to defeat them. Now, the ability, there's no question about. But do we have the will?
And Harold, as you've looked at the mentality of this regime, they're extremely highly attuned to these issues of resolve and will. Are they not? I mean, isn't that part and parcel of kind of the pathology, I guess one might say, of these Iranians who make death to America, death to Israel, their mantra, and have gotten away with that more or less, at least until now?
No, it's true. This is from what I can tell. I mean, I haven't been in Iran in a long time. I went to university there, but it's years ago. Cultures don't change all that quickly. From what I understand, these demonstrations with people out in the streets yelling "Death to America," "Death to Israel," "Death to the British." British are in old Iranian terms the most powerful, believe it or not. These are paid demonstrations. The people get money, they get food if they go out and demonstrate. I don't believe for a moment that's what most of the Iranian people want. If they did want what the government wanted, why would people be out in the streets chanting protests against the government? And why would there be these women violating, it's a very big thing to wear flashy clothes, meaning colorful. You're supposed to wear drab because the only purpose of a woman is to entice men from their point of view. Why do this? This goes against the rules of the regime. That means they hate the regime. They hate them. They love America. They want to be an ally of the United States of America. We should help them, the people.
We should indeed. And Harold, again, just to put a fine point on it, the new line that President Trump has adopted, specifically in connection with the response to the shooting down of an American drone, was that it would have been not proportionate. To what extent, given that the Iranians are so keenly calibrating all of these things, how do they perceive this idea of proportionality as opposed to striking a decisive blow that, you know, would, if not conduce to victory, at least be deeply punitive?
This idea of proportional response or measured response may make us feel good, but it's looked upon as a form of weakness. The answer is get the problem over with, resolve it, stop them from making difficulties for us and our allies. End it. There's no country like the United States of America, nothing with our abilities. We may not want to be the policemen of the world, but that's, whether we like it or not, our role.
Right. Harold, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you for your years of service to our country, Harold, and that you're continuing to provide at the Gatestone Institute. It's deeply appreciated. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Well, it's one of the high points of our week, the chance to visit with Gordon Chang, one of the country's great authorities on Asia and specifically on communist China, and how we best should deal with that present danger. Gordon has, of course, several books to his credit, including The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, Losing South Korea, topic to which we will return momentarily. Gordon is a contributor to The Daily Beast and National Interest and so much more. Of course, Fox News quite regularly, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Gordon, welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
Gordon, I want to start with Hong Kong. There is a growing concern, I think, that the Chinese government, the Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army are going to settle accounts with the freedom-seeking people of Hong Kong, quite possibly in a very brutal way. I'm hearing reports that they're insinuating PLA troops into these so-called police units, and that they're ramping up increasingly the aggressiveness with which they're trying to stop, as well as perhaps apprehend those responsible for the demonstrations. How do you see what's happening at the moment, Gordon? And specifically, are there things that we might do that would help impress upon the Chinese government that if it infringes upon the autonomy of Hong Kong even further, there will be real costs to Beijing as well?
Events over the weekend were extremely disturbing, and it looks like Hong Kong is descending into lawlessness. We had the two big demonstrations. The interesting thing is that the bigger of the two, which was for the pro-democracy forces, the police stopped it short of its natural objective. Mm-hmm. And so there was violence that followed later on. The police apparently have lost control of the situation. They have unnecessarily, for instance, charged groups of journalists and using violence against them unnecessarily. We've also seen tear gas, rubber bullets. And what was really quite extraordinary was a group of thugs, about 100 or so, dressed all in the same white uniform, were attacking pro-democracy demonstrators as they were returning on the subway, the MTR, Mass Transit Railway. They were being beaten with sticks and with other implements, and the police just withdrew and sort of watched all of this occur. So there are right now, it's unclear as to what's happening, but it is descending into lawlessness. And as the second part of your question, the United States needs to take a firm response, and this very well may include withdrawing all sorts of privileges that the U.S. has accorded Hong Kong. Hong Kong is a part of the People's Republic of China. but it's been promised autonomy for 50 years. That promise has been repudiated, especially because Beijing has said it's no longer abiding by the 1984 Sino-British Joint Declaration, which has the status of a treaty. The U.S. needs to take firm measures right now with regard to Beijing, because the situation in Hong Kong can deteriorate fast.
Yeah, and I think it would be a grave mistake to think that whatever goes down in Hong Kong will be confined to Hong Kong. It seems to me that if we fall prey to the temptation to treat this as just an internal matter, which is, of course, Xi Jinping's insistent position, Gordon, that this will not translate into an increased conviction on the part of the Chinese Communist Party that they can behave with similar kind of aggressiveness elsewhere, don't you think?
Well, yes. I mean, the Trump administration is following traditional American diplomacy, which really has been to try to accommodate China. And by doing that, we try to think we're buying friendship. On the contrary, we're showing the Chinese that we're weak. That's the way they interpret it. So they press the advantage, and the situation continues to move in directions we don't want. So we have for decades been encouraging the type of behavior we're trying to prevent. And so, Frank, while, you know, and I've said this before in different contexts, but we've got to understand that we have, through very bad diplomacy, continually applied over the course of many, many years, should know better. And the Trump administration is taking some steps to move away from that foreign policy consensus. But nonetheless, in crucial moments, it falls back on failed tactics.
Yeah, we're going to talk a bit more about this consensus or emerging view. The New York Times featured it prominently, I believe, on its front page yesterday, that there's a red scare over China. And our little Committee on the Present Danger was featured rather prominently in it, surprisingly. But it does seem as though the facts are the facts. And the reality is that China is becoming a bigger problem, and it's harder and harder to ignore it. And I hope the president won't, in connection with this Hong Kong business. Let me ask you, Gordon, about trade talks that the president is very keen on, of course. There are reports that it has come to a standstill because China is insisting on accommodations vis-a-vis Huawei, something the president had indicated would be in the offing to some extent during the meeting he had with Xi Jinping in Osaka, Japan recently. What's your current sense of what's happening with respect to Huawei specifically, but more generally in the trade talks as well?
Well, with regard to the general trade talks, they have not gone anywhere. There have been phone conversations between the two lead negotiators, Vice Premier Lo He and Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, but there's been no meeting scheduled, and I think that's crucial. There was supposedly a truce when President Trump met his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping at the Osaka G20. That was the end of last month, but there doesn't seem to be very much progress. It all hinges, everyone says, on what the United States will do with regard to Huawei technologies. It's been added to the Commerce Department's entity list, which means no U.S. company can transact business with it on high-tech matters, except with licenses. And apparently the Trump administration is going to grant licenses. I think that we're seeing China believe that they can push the Trump administration around. We're going to get a very, very good readout in the next couple days because we're moving towards that August 13th or August 19th deadline. The Trump administration gave a 3-month reprieve, which expires the middle of August. And we're going to see what the administration is going to do, because it is meeting with U.S. chip companies and tech companies who are looking for a permanent relief. And so the Chinese, as along with everybody else, will be watching how firm the resolve of the Trump administration is. And we've got to be very concerned that we're going to be giving reprieves to Huawei that are just not justified.
Yeah. There's a piece in the Washington Post today that adds further grounds for not going there. It reports, as you know, I'm sure, Gordon, that Huawei was responsible for helping to build North Korea's wireless network, a sanctions-busting activity with very significant national security implications, too, I think it's fair to say. Gordon, let me turn to another area that you've been very focused on, and I think necessarily so. What's going on in South Korea? Your book, Losing South Korea, from Encounter Books, is a terrific short read on what President Moon Jae-in is up to there. And I wanted to ask you for an update in the context of what specifically he's been doing of late, greatly to exacerbate relations between South Korea on the one hand and Japan on the other, the two bulwarks, really, of American, you know, sort of strategy and force posture in the Western Pacific. What's going on, and what are the implications as you see them?
Well, Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, has been deliberately causing friction with Japan on a number of different fronts relating to mutual defense matters. And Moon is probably doing this because he wants to bolster sagging popularity. Not long ago, maybe 6, 7, 8 months, he had a popularity rating in the mid-80s. It fell to the low 40s, recovered a little bit after the surprise summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un at the end of last month, where he just barely edged over the 50% mark. But long-term, Moon is in trouble for a number of reasons. And so the way to bolster this, I guess, in his mind, is to create this friction with Japan. Of course, this is important for us because both South Korea and Japan are our treaty partners, but South Korea and Japan are not treaty partners among themselves. We have trying to encourage cooperation, especially with mutual intelligence sharing pact, which Moon looks like he wants to repudiate. So things are going in a bad direction. The Trump administration is taking a hands-off view, which is absolutely the wrong way to approach this. We need to look back to what was done in the Obama administration, where there were real efforts to mend the relations between Tokyo and Seoul. We need to go back to that old approach because we're the biggest victims of this, or close to the biggest victims of this friction.
Yeah. Well, it's the view of one of our colleagues, Lawrence Peck, that it augurs very badly, of course, for our strategic position at a very critical moment with the negotiations with Kim Jong-un going on and the difficulties we've been discussing about China happening, of course, in the neighborhood as well. But that beyond that, there may well be a sort of playbook being established here on Moon's part for a similar kind of action against the United States in due course. And I think one just cannot overstate the implications here of having a very unfriendly so-called ally in the Blue House in Seoul. Gordon, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us again next week. In the meantime, stay very well, my friend. Next up, Kevin Freeman joins us. We'll deal with these topics and more straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Kevin Freeman, the man we have the privilege of consulting with weekly and working with closely between times as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, our duty expert on economic warfare matters, the subject of his television program on Blaze TV, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. You can find out how you can view it at economicwarroom.com. He is also the author of two terrific books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and a very active contributor to the public policy debate in various media, including this one, we're very pleased to say. Kevin, it's good to have you back, as always. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, you have just recently unburdened yourself of a piece that seems to be very timely, very needed, about today's existential threat being communist China. You'll get no argument from me on that, but give us the essence of the argument as you see it.
Well, yeah, the piece is in globaleconomicwarfare.com, my blog, and the title is The Greatest External Threat is China. And it is a pushback on really an effort that's being made to say that Russia's our greatest threat. It's not China. It's led mostly by Democratic candidates. It was prominently featured in the Democratic presidential debate where they worry about Russia, which is a fraction of the size of China in terms of economy. And I'm not suggesting that we dismiss Putin as a threat. We dismiss Russia as a threat. They certainly are, but they're not of the size or substance that China is. And China is a massive human rights abuser and so forth. All the things that the Committee on the Present Danger of China has pointed out are true. And yet I think there's some Chinese-led propaganda supported by the Democratic Party that's saying that they're not really a threat.
Well, that certainly was Joe Biden's view, but then he changed it. And the rest of them, it seems, have been more or less okay with calling the Chinese out. We'll see as these debates continue to illuminate their various positions. I was at a meeting, a ministerial meeting that was convened by Secretary of State Pompeo last week about religious freedom. Nancy Pelosi appeared and was fairly forthright, as I think she's generally been, about the danger that China represents, particularly to, you know, religious freedom, but for other purposes as well. So there seems to me to be an emerging sense among people of both parties and lots of others besides that China is a real problem. You wouldn't know that, though, from an open letter that was signed out on the 3rd of July by people I call engagers who are quite critical of Donald Trump's more robust policies and very anxious to see the United States return to what in the old days of the Cold War we used to call détente with China. Engagement, I guess, is the term they prefer today. Kevin, did you happen to see that letter, and did you find its arguments persuasive?
Hey, I did see the letter, and the arguments are certainly not persuasive, and yet that's the same kind of basic pushback that I got when I was working inside the Pentagon and warning of the economic war that was taking place. The argument is, oh no, these are just potential partners, that they are just seeking their place in the world. It's just a rising economy and so forth. It is absolutely not correct. That viewpoint misses entirely the point President Xi Jinping with his China dream. He wants to see China dominate the world and basically be emperor of that Chinese world.
Yeah. And this was responded to by an even larger group, of which we were a part, that contested this idea, very much strongly supported President Trump's, that appeared in the Journal of Political Risk and elsewhere. And I also took them on in some comments that I made, which you can find at presentdangerchina.org, to really gainsay this sort of argument that if we just continue business as usual, Kevin Freeman, somehow this is going to get better. It seems like the old line attributed to Albert Einstein about if insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and thinking you're going to get different results. This is a formula for real disaster, it seems to me. This brings me to a subject that was also discussed in our program on Thursday of last week, the Committee on the Present Danger China, featuring our colleague Roger Robinson, who was on your program recently, and I think he made many of the same points in both settings. But talk a little bit about, Kevin, as you see it, the real danger that Roger is warning of, that we're going to find ourselves enabling the Chinese not only to gain immense amounts of money through our capital markets, but in the process to recruit, if you will, as a new vastly expanded China lobby, people whose pension funds, for example, may suddenly be, you know, tied up with China, and they'll have a powerful incentive not to have any difficulties with the People's Republic.
Well, it's actually a brilliant approach. The Chinese Communist Party has been bailed out by America multiple times. Our friend Gordon Chang talks about that we've saved their economy multiple times. The current iteration of that salvation, they're running out of dollars. They're running out of hard currency. They've angered a lot of people with their Belt and Road Initiative. They've repossessed properties and so forth. And they need access to capital. And that capital had come very directly from initial public offerings in the United States, like Alibaba and other places. But most recently, they have lobbied effectively with the MSCI that China is underrepresented in the global and international stock market indices. So if you buy a stock market index, you end up owning a certain percentage Chinese shares. And they've argued that that should be quadrupled, which forces index managers, and index investing has become very popular in America. It's the largest trend out there. So if you're an index manager, you have to buy these Chinese stocks, and that would force into pension funds of every American that has an index in their fund to own these Chinese shares. And these Chinese companies are doing horrible things in certain cases, either putting people in concentration camps, or they're monitoring their citizens, or they're building aircraft carriers that will be used against America. We're literally funding our own demise if we continue to go down this path.
Yeah. And Kevin, you have been working for some time. We've discussed this before, but I don't think it can be said often enough how much I admire what you've been doing and how needed it is. And that is training of financial advisors to help them understand that you can make good money investing in ways that are not inimical to our national security, as opposed to what one of our friends, Kyle Bass, has called the MSSI approach. Instead of MSCI, the Ministry of State Security seems to be a better name for the index now, to the extent it is going to include these very unsavory Chinese companies. Tell us a little bit about the National Security Investment Consultant Institute.
Yeah, what we do is we have recognized that the average American investors really don't want their money funding their own demise. And advisors have just not at all looked into the national security implications. And so we just started a program several years ago, and Frank, you were a part of it. We just brought advisors in and we trained them. We showed them these are national security implications of investments. Because the real war that we're fighting is an economic war, and the way that you fight that's with money. And so we've mobilized advisors and investors. The investors should want advisors that will help protect their future and their children's future, and the advisors should want clients that believe in America. And the advisors are all the time looking to find new clients and new niches. This is one that's been unexploited. So we started training advisors, and the response has been tremendous. People want their money to invest in America's future, and as a result, their advisors are beginning to come to us and say, "Please help us understand this niche and help us understand how to participate in it." And the niche is really the general investment population. We think ultimately this will become one of the most important things an advisor can do, is to recognize how those investments will impact the future of their clients.
Yeah, it's so true and so needed. Kevin Freeman, such important work. We appreciate you tremendously, as we do all that is flowing from your Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Again, I commend economicwarroom.com as a vehicle for finding out how you can learn not only how to access the program itself, but also the blueprints that Kevin provides helpfully after each of his programs. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.